Right. Hello, and welcome back to Real Seekers. I'm your host, Dale, the Real Seeker. Today's an extra special treat for the Shroud Wearers. I was a guest on my friend SJ Thomason's channel, continuing on with my Shroud series, teaching her about certain topics from giving my perspective from an in-depth side view of things. And on this show, we covered the carbon-14 dating, the Sudarium of Oviedo, and the Hungarian Prey Codex. So enjoy the show as follows. I know SJ was really impressed with it, and you'll be happy to know as the audience, we've already set up the show with Bob Rucker to talk about, on SJ's channel, his image forming, the vertically collimated radiation burst hypothesis for how the body images, the blood stains were formed, as well as the carbon-14. So that's going to be on Saturday, May 11th at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time on SJ Thomason's channel. So tune into that. Obviously, when Hugh Ferry heard that Bob was going to be coming on to SJ's channel, he was very, very happy about that. Right, Hugh?
No! No, 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 no! No! No, 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 no!
Okay, maybe not. Anyways, let's get into the episode with SJ here. Enjoy.
Welcome, everybody. This is SJ Thomason, and I'm here with Dale of Real Seekers. And if you're wondering whether or not the Shroud of Turin is the actual burial cloth of Jesus Christ, you have come to the right place, because we are going to provide lots of evidence in support of that. And we weren't looking to prove that initially. We both legitimately just went and looked at the evidence. And we can show you through these slides the way that the 1988 carbon dating has been debunked, and the way that we should be really focusing instead on what late research has said, what the research of late, I should say, and what people are saying about the Shroud of Turin, because it comes from all different angles. And so without further ado, I'm just going to turn this right over to Dale.
Hey, SJ. Yeah, thank you so much. So yeah, I'm happy to be back on to continue the Shroud series and that. I saw the videos you did with Otangelo and Joe Marino there, so those were always great, of course. And I just wanted to reach out to kind of continue what we've been doing. So if you want to go to the next slide, I'll just give a recap.
Okay, I can do that. Yeah, I'll move it. Can you move it too or no?
No, it's only you that controls.
Okay. So I'll just move it as we go.
Okay, cool. So just to summarize where we've been, basically I split up Shroud studies into two separate categories of study. There's on the image formation and are the images miraculous. So far with SJ, I've covered two artistic mechanisms. One, we looked at Walter Macron's traditional painting hypothesis, and we totally refuted that. The other one is we looked at the proto-photo hypothesis of Nicholas Allen. And once again, we totally refuted that. Remember, that's that primitive pinhole camera technology that he supposed existed. On the historical dating side, we kind of looked at the Bishop Darcy memorandum, and I refuted that. That was that medieval bishop who claimed the Shroud was just a painting made in the 1350s, and I showed that document was unreliable. And the second thing we did the last time I was on is we had Larry Stolle come on to make his case that certain biblical texts actually cryptically refer to Shroud images. So I want to move on to three more dating evidences. If you go to the next slide there. Okay. So today we're going to be covering three things. So one, the 1988 carbon-14 dating, which allegedly shows the Shroud is medieval. Believe it or not, I think the carbon-14 dating evidence can be used to prove the opposite. Secondly, we have the Hungarian Prey Codex. And then thirdly, we have the evidence from the Sudarium of Oviedo, all of which place the Shroud back well past the medieval period, well before that. Let's go to the next slide. It's probably better if I control it, I think, faster, but all right. So
starting, how can we do that? Do you know how to do it so we can control it?
If you don't mind, like, I can just share my screen.
Okay.
I think that would be best. on. See if it's clear. If it's not as clear, then we'll just go this way and I'll skip the videos. But
okay, so let's see. Is that this one, I think?
Yeah. Is that showing up?
Yes, it is. It's moving, luckily.
Okay, perfect.
Okay.
Okay, cool. So in terms of the 1988 carbon-14 dating, everyone knows the Shroud was dated in 1988. And the next year, in 1989, the journal Nature published that the Shroud's a medieval fake. It dates from 1260 to 1390 with a claimed 95% degree of confidence. Now, when we're assessing this claim, there are two separate issues or aspects that need to be looked at. So the first question is, are Shroud skeptics rationally justified or warranted in believing that the Shroud is actually medieval in terms of its actual calendar age on the basis of this carbon dating? And secondly, is there any empirical data, given the empirical data from the carbon-14 dating, is this consistent with the Shroud dating back to the first century or not? Now, to answer these questions, I break up my assessment into two parts. Number one, providing undercutting defeaters. So these are things that defeat the Shroud skeptics' rational justification for believing the Shroud really is medieval because of the carbon dating. And the second is that we have various pro-Shroud explanations that make the Shroud carbon-14 data consistent with the Shroud actually dating to the first century. So just to kind of summarize what the four undercutting defeaters are for aspect one, these are reasons I present that defeat the Shroud skeptics' justification. Number one, the AMS carbon-14 dating method at the time it dated the Shroud was unreliable. Secondly, they only dated one sample location, and this is an insufficient sample size. Thirdly, there is some empirical data suggesting the sample taken was non-representative to the rest of the cloth. That's what SJ loves and Joe Marino's been on. That's kind of suggestive of an invisible reweave there. And then fourthly, there's another category of non-representative evidence suggesting the sample was non-representative. And this leads to various statistical problems and a provable systemic bias. And this is going to be new, I hope, for Stephanie's audience here. So, okay, looking at aspect number two then, what about that second question? But how would we get the Shroud being consistent with the first century, given it did give these medieval results? And there have been five pro-Shroud strategies. So the first one that ever came up were conspiracy theories, right? So you have Stephen Jones saying, oh, this was during the Cold War, so there were Russian hackers who hacked into the computers and gave these medieval results just to, falsify the Shroud. There was also some pro-Shroud guys who suggested, well, look, Michael Tite, he took the Shroud sample against the protocols backstage off camera. And when this happened, they did the old switcheroo. They swapped in a medieval sample, and that's why we got medieval results. You can also just say, yeah, they purposefully fudged data because it was not a blind test, and it was supposed to be. The carbon-14 scientists knew in advance what they were dating and what dates they needed to get. The second strategy is through ordinary forms of contamination. So from bacteria, wax, smoke, fire, all of these various types of ordinary forms of contamination have been suggested. And quite obviously, the carbon-14 labs have various rigorous cleaning procedures to try and take care of this before they date the carbon-14 samples. The third strategy is another form of ordinary contamination. This is the invisible reweave hypothesis that Joe Marino came up with and others. Then there are two hypotheses of extraordinary forms of contamination. So the first is by Dr. John Jackson, and he suggested maybe carbon monoxide contamination increased the carbon-14 content, making it date younger, even though it comes from the first century, it looked like it was medieval. And the good news is we have scientifically falsified this. The Oxford Radiocarbon Lab tested for this experimentally 2008, and they have proven this is not a valid explanation. So this one has to be ruled out. But then we come to my personal favorite, neutron irradiation. And this is a form of extraordinary contamination by people like Bob Rucker and others. And that's what I'm going to be trying to make the case for today, which is different than what Joe Marino and others have argued. Okay, so let's look at each of my defeaters for the Shroud Skeptic here. So the first was, remember, the method is just unreliable in general for dating the Shroud at that time. And I have some quotes here, so I'll just, to save time, I'll quote one. But look, even back in 1989, New Scientist published a paper about a detailed study by Britain's Science and Engineering Research Council that compared the accuracy of 38 carbon-14 labs using artifacts of known age. And these included AMS carbon-14 labs, which was the newest carbon-14 technique that was used on the Shroud. And they gave their final conclusion as, quote unquote, the margin of error with carbon-14 dating, AMS carbon-14 dating, seems to be as much as 2 to 3 times as great as practitioners of the technique have claimed. Of the 38 labs investigated, only 7 produced results that the organizers of the trial considered to be satisfactory. So this is a huge problem. And because of this issue with the AMS carbon-14 labs, Stirp and other scientists got together to do, in 1983, with 5 AMS carbon-14 labs, to do an intercomparison test. And these included all 3 of the labs that actually dated the Shroud in 1988. And guess what? Utter failure. With the first group of experiments, the 6 out of 11 gave dates wrong by more than half of the sample's actual known age. And when they added a third sample of known age and tested it again, a total of 7 out of the 17 experiments included all 5 of the labs getting the ages wrong, again, by half the known age of the samples used. So this is definitely, I mean, at the very least, if you're a Shroud skeptic, this should definitely cause you reasonable doubt, just based on what we have here. And I have a quick little clip of Michael Kowalski talking about this. So he's the editor of the BSTS. So I'll just go to that video quickly. Oops. Is that showing up, the video, Stephanie?
Sorry, I was getting my mute. Yes, it's showing up.
Okay, all right, just a couple minutes here.
So then get to 1983 when I think it was Robert Otlet of Harwell who decided that because there were so many laboratories involved, it would be a good idea to actually have some kind of test that would assess the accuracy of the various different laboratories and the 2 techniques that were in fashion at the time, which was the AMS and the more established gas counter technique. So that led to the intercomparison test that was supervised by Michael Tite from the British Museum, who of course eventually went on to supervise the radiocarbon dating of the Shroud. And that test involved 6 laboratories: Oxford in England, Harwell in England. It involved Zurich from Switzerland, and 3 laboratories from America: Rochester, Arizona, and Brookhaven. Now, when it came to conduct that test, Michael Tite, first of all, gave them a sample, which was some Egyptian linen that was 3,000 years, dated to 3,000 years BC. That was tested, and 5 of the 6 laboratories got a fairly accurate date, but the 6th laboratory had a date that was 1,000 years out, way out. A second sample was provided, which was some Peruvian cotton that dated to 1200 AD. And in that particular instance, all 6 laboratories failed to date that accurately. I believe the dates came out between 1400 AD and 1670 AD. And then there was a final test, which only 5 of the laboratories participated in. And again, it was another sample of Peruvian cotton. This one dated to the period 1000 AD to 1400 AD. And once again, there was one laboratory that got a date that was way out, again, 1,000 years out, whereas all the other laboratories managed to date this accurately. Now, that as a series of tests wasn't a particular success, and a little bit troubling that some of the results were really quite big errors.
So that's kind of the clip there in a nutshell. You can see that there were problems with this AMS Carbon 14 lab, just a new method invented 10 years before it was used to date the shroud. And there are some problems here in terms of its general reliability. The second defeater was, remember, they only dated that single shroud sample location. And look, I forget the pro-shroud side. Hey, I'm a biased pro-shroud guy. Let me quote the famous shroud skeptic, the carbon 14 scientist, the guy who invented AMS carbon 14 technology, Dr. Harry Gove himself. What does he say about the validity of believing the shroud's medieval on the basis of dating one sample location? Well, he says, quote unquote, the new procedure is bound to produce a dating result that will be questioned in strictly scientific terms by many scientists around the world who will be very skeptical of the arbitrarily small statistical basis for our testing one sample. The use of a single sample is ill-advised as it will not generate a reliable date. We suggest that it would be better not to date the shroud at all. Bam. That's case closed, I would say, for the shroud skeptics there. Okay, defeater three. I'm not going to get into much details here because, SJ, you've done lots of shows. You've had our mutual friend Joe Marino on the show, and he has advocated on your show already for the invisible reweave hypothesis. And he's brought up certain evidences, such as finding cotton in the area embedded in that area sample, which is non-representative to the rest of the cloth, you know, the blue quad mosaic, Dr. Al Adler's salt findings, and those sorts of things. So I'm not, just to save time, I'm not going to go over that again, but just be aware, there is empirical evidence that Joe Marino and others have suggested proves there was an invisible reweave. And here's just my kind of summary of the evidence. You can see there are pros and cons, right? So here are some of the pros, such as the cotton, the salt findings, yellow matter dye has been found in the sample. But there, it's important to note there are cons against the invisible reweave as well, such as the fact that if it were true, 80% of the material would have to be new material, would have to be rewoven material from the 1500s, and only about 20% would be from 30 AD in order to get the medieval results that we got. And it's claimed that, well, if it were 80%, we should be able to see that apparently. But as some people say, well, the textile experts, they can't detect this patch. Another con evidence here against it is that there are continuous horizontal striations, including into the sample location, that Dr. John Jackson, and he's the head of STIRP, he's a pro-shroud guy, he's found, and he has been quoted as saying that makes the invisible reweave hypothesis impossible. So I just wanted to give you, yep, so here's kind of a visual. There are pros, empirical evidence supporting it. There's also some reasons against the invisible reweave. So what I want to present, SJ, that's new, is another alternative, the one I go for, which is the fact that the shroud sample appears to have been neutron irradiated in such a way as to give us medieval results. And people like Bob Rucker, Mark Antonacci, Thomas McAvoy, and these guys are pro-shroud experts, and they've conducted statistical analysis of the data provided from the carbon 14 data in 1988. Essentially, Tristan Casabianca sued the British Museum through a Freedom of Information Act to obtain the raw data, which until then was hidden by the British Museum. And what they discovered is that basically it was a total lie this whole time. Since 1989, the scientists had lied to the people about having this 95% degree of confidence that the shroud dated from 1260 to 1390, because what they did is they divided the sample into 12 subsamples. And when you take that all into account and do the mathematics using a chi-square test, you discover there is a 98, there is a slope or a gradient of the data, so that each of the 12 dates follows a linear path, getting from the edge of the cloth, getting younger by 36 years for every centimeter you go in towards the center of the cloth. And what that proves mathematically is that there is a 98.6% probability that there's some kind of systematic bias or systemic error that is causing the results in these medieval dates to come out as they are. But because of that, we cannot have a 95% degree of confidence that the 1260 to 1390 dates represent the actual calendar age of the shroud. They're meaningless, what they got. You have to just dismiss them. And I had a clip of Bob Rucker, a 6-minute clip. How are we doing on time? Should I just skip that, SJ, or do we 450? Okay, you know what? I will play this.
I think we're doing well on time.
Awesome.
Hey, okay. I want to mention Joe Marino's in the house.
Hey, Joe, how's it going? All right. So here's Bob Rucker.
Let me just ask you one question. I see this name, and I feel like this might be somebody you referenced, Hugh Ferry.
Yep. He is probably the ultimate and most knowledgeable shroud skeptic in the world. I would argue he's the top of the crop on the shroud skeptic side.
Peace up, A-Town. Yeah. Okay. Usher.
Well, John.
Yeah.
So he's in the house too.
He's a friend. I like having him on the show, but he'll probably be cutting me up. So Joe, you can tackle him in the chat while I do the thing. But cool. So I just want to play this 6-minute clip. This is Bob Rucker explaining how his hypothesis, neutron irradiation, can explain how a first century cloth gave us the medieval dates. So let's listen to that.
For this is that the carbon dates from the three laboratories did not agree with each other within their uncertainties. A chi-squared statistical analysis of the data indicates there is only about a 1.4% chance that the distribution of the carbon dates is consistent with their uncertainties. This indicates that a systematic error or bias was likely present in the carbon dates. This systematic error was a function of the distance from the bottom of the cloth, as shown in this figure. The y-axis in this figure is...
And just before, sorry to interrupt, but this is undeniable. Hugh Ferry will not deny this data. This has been published in about 5 to 6 secular peer-reviewed science journals. So this data is not controversial, what Bob's talking about right here.
The carbon date obtained from the laboratories, and the x-axis is the distance from the bottom of the cloth. The three points are the average values from the three laboratories, and each vertical bar shows the 1 sigma uncertainty. 1 sigma means there is about a 68% probability that the true value falls within this range. A constant 1260 date indicated by the black dashed line only passes through one laboratory's carbon date, but misses the other two. The red slope line is a much better fit to the data, with a slope or gradient of about 36 years per centimeter. How is this slope in the experimental data to be explained? Since it is unlikely that the uncertainties in the carbon dates is the correct explanation. To explain this slope in the experimental data, nuclear analysis computer calculations were run using MCNP. MCNP stands for Monte Carlo N particle, where N stands for neutrons. This software was developed at the Los Alamos National Laboratory over several decades and is approved for general nuclear calculations by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, NRC. MCNP was used to model a man wrapped in a linen cloth laying on the back bench or shelf in a limestone tomb as it would have been designed in first century Jerusalem. In these computer calculations, neutrons were emitted uniformly or homogeneously throughout the body since the radiation burst had to occur throughout the body to produce the full front and dorsal body images. MCNP then calculated the resulting neutron distribution in the tomb and thus the distribution of neutrons absorbed in the trace amounts of nitrogen in the shroud and thus the distribution of new carbon-14 produced in the fibers that would have shifted the carbon date forward. The results are shown in this slide. The y-axis is MCNP's predicted carbon date that would be experimentally measured. The x-axis is the position in centimeters along the center line of the dorsal image on the section of the cloth that was below the body in the tomb.
So just to quickly explain, you know, so he's saying, suppose this is the body of Jesus in the tomb and it's covered by the shroud cloth, right? The y-axis represents the carbon-14 date that they would get. And based on neutrons from the body of Jesus at the time of the resurrection, this would mix with the nitrogen in the linen cloth and create extra carbon-14, which would make the shroud date differently depending on how many neutrons reached it. So in 1988, they carbon dated this little section of the shroud around the shroud man's feet. And guess what? This calculation matches the data. We got that medieval date. But if you were to carbon date in the center of the shroud man, there would be so much neutron irradiation there, we would carbon date and get something in the future, 8,500 AD. In the future. So this is showing how the amount of neutron radiation is predicted to affect what carbon dates we would get. So far, we've only carbon dated this little section, which corresponds to the medieval place, but it also matches that slope, that 36 years per centimeter slope. So yeah, I'll let Bob finish.
The curve is quite
let me get clarification really quickly, because I'm looking at this and I see AD, and obviously we're only 2024 years into AD. So what these years on the side, I don't really get how those line up, because it goes all the way up to 9,000.
Exactly, because these are carbon 14 dates, right? It's giving a date based on the amount of carbon 14 in relation to the equilibrium state, right? It's assuming
it's got dates into the future. Is that, am I reading that right, or is this 2024 minus these numbers?
No, you are reading that correctly, because there is so much radiation, neutron radiation in the center mass of Jesus' body. If his hypothesis is true, and the carbon dating is a result of neutron irradiation, there would have been so much radiation at this part of the shroud cloth, we would get a carbon 14, so many carbon 14 atoms, it would translate to a date in the future, 8,500. Mm-hmm. So this is a way of a prediction that it makes that would absolutely prove his hypothesis. So yeah,
that's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And shows a maximum carbon date of about 8,500 AD for a point under the center of mass of the body. The carbon date to the future, such as this, is calculated when the ratio of carbon-14 to carbon-12 is higher in the sample than exists in our surroundings. The curve in the diagram is normalized to the three laboratories' average value of 1260 AD at the second point from the left, which is where the samples were cut from the shroud in 1988. The amazing thing to realize is that the slope of the curve at the second point from the left is in close agreement with the slope of the carbon dates measurements by the three laboratories, about 36 years per centimeter in the previous slide. This indicates that the slope of the experimental carbon dates as a function of the distance from the bottom of the shroud can be explained by the distribution of the neutrons in the tomb that results from neutrons being homogeneously emitted from the body.
Okay. So I'm going to end the clip there. So I think that gives you a helpful visual of what Bob Rucker's neutron irradiation hypothesis is, right? And it's important to note, am I back at the slides?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, cool. All right, cool. So now it's important to note with the carbon-14 data, there are at least four bits of data that any hypothesis, the invisible reweave or neutron irradiation or whatever hypothesis you give, Hugh Ferry, Shroud Skeptical, ordinary contamination thing, you have to explain all four of these empirical data. Number one, that the carbon labs got the correct dates for the control samples that they got. Secondly, there's the average date for the corner of the shroud, right? So that's the raw 1260 to 1390 that was reported back in 1989 as the date for the shroud. But there's also the distribution of the 12 subsample dates that they got. Remember, Oxford it doesn't overlap the labs. If you remember, overlap the other labs, it's way out there. If you remember the little line chart there, the line of best fit. And then there's that slope, that gradient where the 12 subsamples are arranged linearly and systematically, getting younger 36 years for every single centimeter from the edge of the clock to the thing. Now, the neutron radiation hypothesis explains all of this empirical data. So this is a point in its favor kind of thing, right? It can explain all of the data that's uncontroversial and that we got from the 1988 carbon-14 dating. Don't believe me? Let me quote our good buddy in the audience, Shroud Skeptic Hugh Ferry. This one's for you, Hugh.
No, God! No, God, please, no! 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 No!
He was going to say this himself. So, okay, 24 to 25, 30. Okay. Let me bring up Hugh saying this in his own words. So here he is.
That you should believe in the carbon-14. Now we're here on number four. This is really what Bob and Hugh have been debating here. And Bob has been clear that, look, this aspect should destroy your confidence. You should be, at the very least, agnostic, or he's presented through his mechanism, you should believe that the shroud is not medieval on the basis of the carbon-14 results. Hugh, I want to get from you. So are you saying that what Bob is saying here is kind of an equally probable explanation? Should we be agnostic?
No, well, Bob's explanation fits the data, which I think is fine. And he's right. It does account for other ideas, not at least, or it can do, and four possible ideas. And it is testable.
There you go. In Hugh's own words, the ultimate shroud skeptic confirming what I just said there to you guys. But it gets better than this, right? Because we actually have other data that could be proving positively that the shroud was indeed irradiated by neutrons. And that explains the carbon-14 data. So I'll start from the bottom up here. So one is that we have the carbon dating of the Sudarium of Oviedo. And that carbon dated to it was carbon dated three times, about 700 AD as an average date. And guess what? This coincidentally, remember Bob's gradient there? If the Sudarium was in fact the headcloth of Jesus, and as the Gospels tell us, it was placed on the side bench, Bob Rucker has used his Monte Carlo neutron particle software, which is of the U.S. federal government. This is the most sophisticated software from the Department of Energy in the world. And he has calculated, guess what? If that's where the Sudarium were placed, on the side bench next to the shroud, just as the Gospels say, what date would we carbon date it to if there was neutron irradiation? 700 AD. So it perfectly fits the data and explains the data from the Sudarium of Oviedo. And that makes it superior. The invisible reweave doesn't give us an explanation for the carbon dating of the Sidereum of Oviedo. You would have to come up with some other additional explanation to explain why that's messed up. It, you know, does the Sidereum have an invisible patch, or, you know, whatever, however you want to explain that, if they're linked. The second is that Giulio Fonte has actually done studies into the blood, and he's found an anomalous feature where there's a lack, almost a total lack of nitrogen in the blood stains. And here's his finding here. And that, how could that possibly happen? Well, again, remember, the neutrons would mix, and that would create new carbon-14 content with, so that's why there's no nitrogen, because the neutrons are mixing with the nitrogen, creating this new carbon-14 content. So yeah, this is a startling find, and it has been proven that if neutron irradiation happened, it would result in this lack of nitrogen in the bloodstains. And sure enough, that's what we find with the Shroud of Turin's bloodstains, according to Dr. Giulio Fonte. So this is, again, evidence supporting positively that Bob's neutron absorption hypothesis is true. And then we come to my favorite. Hugh's not going to like this, but Dr. Tom McAvoy was on my show, and he found this amazing correspondence. He looked at the Shroud's ultraviolet fluorescence intensity studies, and it's been perfectly correlated to Bob Rucker's MCNP neutron irradiation hypothesis. And I just want to, so here's just the visual, right? So here's Bob Rucker's calculations for the carbon dating. And what this is right here is what was dated in 1988 by the carbon-14 scientists. Now, totally independently, Dr. Tom McAvoy has published in Applied Optics, secular science journal, not a religious thing. He's looked at the average ultraviolet fluorescence intensity, and we get the same pattern. Very interesting. So I just want to play a clip of Tom discussing this, because I think this is something that is amazing. So let me bring that up quickly. Okay, so let's listen to Dr. Tom McAvoy explain this remarkable correspondence.
Summarizes what I had found, again, data from the Shroud. The UV fluorescence intensity is highest at the midsection of the center of the dorsal image. And that's the green image on the left is the dorsal image. And that's the highest value of any of them. The fluorescence intensity is higher on the dorsal image than the frontal. And this means you compare feet to feet, and then, you know, maybe the knee to the knee, torso to the torso, etc. And then the fluorescence intensity is higher on the top side of the image than the bottom side of it. And so the question I had after getting these results is, what could cause these unique fluorescence properties of the Shroud itself? And I mentioned that Phillips had hypothesized that neutron radiation arising from the body covered by the Shroud could, one, alter its radiocarbon dating and create long-lived radioactive isotopes of chlorine and calcium in the Shroud. It does not account for the image formation. Okay, and it's just a very brief, it's almost like one page letter to the editor. I became familiar with, and I've actually interacted with Bob Rucker and what he did, and he published this in 2014 and is working on it and has worked on it since. But he simulated neutron radiation. He actually simulated Phillips' hypothesis. And his main assumption is that in the simulation is that the thermal neutrons were emitted homogeneously or uniformly, if you will, from within the body and isotropically or uniformly in all directions. And the simulation then calculated radiocarbon dates for various points on the Shroud. And he has here, there are two schematics I've taken from Bob's papers. One shows how the body in the Shroud was laid out, the top one, and then the bottom one shows his model of the tomb, and you can see that to the right of the body there's a wall, to the left there's empty space. And he had this code that I believe he had worked on when he was at the lab out in Washington
that he used for his simulations, and he ran a bunch of Monte Carlo simulations. And here's what he got in terms of his radiocarbon dating. And this is now down the center. He had results down the whole shroud. I'm just showing the center image here. And if you look at the circle, you can see that comes from the area of the shroud that was actually radiocarbon dated. And you can see there's a pretty significant gradient there. And we saw when we looked at the numbers, it was about 90 years per inch. So there's a pretty steep gradient over there. And as you get closer to the center of the shroud, then it becomes younger and younger and younger. And eventually you wind up having it date to the future. But these are his results. And the x-axis or the y-axis here are the radiocarbon dates that he's calculating. When I plot my UV results, and again, the UV are results from the shroud, I was amazed. I got the same same type of curve, or plot. You can see that there's a double max.
So, yeah, that I think that kind of explains, right? Like these are independent studies, the MCMP and the UV study that Dr. Tom McAvoy did here. So it's, come on now.
I just want to comment because I think Hugh Ferry is in the chat and he kind of clarified a couple of things that I just want to say so it's on video saying it, besides just saying what he said in the chat. So he said, hold on, my thing's not going up. I want to say hi, by the way, to Hugh Ferry, Captive Desk, Joe Marino, Slam RN, Otangelo. Got a lot of good people here, Diagoras of Melos, and Captive Desk. I guess I named him already. Shiami, great to see all of you guys. But I wanted to say, so Hugh Ferry says, the radiocarbon dating is based on the proportion of C14 found in the artifact compared to the proportion in the air today. Usually there is less C14 than there is today, so the artifact is older. And he said, if there is more C14 than there is today, obviously no determination of any age is possible. But if the number is plugged into the conversion equation, then a future date is the result. It does not mean that, in fact, the artifact does come from the future. And so then he explained down here, he says, the extra carbon having been created by neutron radiation from the resurrecting Christ.
Yeah, I mean, so that's just, it's obvious, right? Like that no one here is claiming that the shroud actually did, in terms of the actual calendar age of the shroud, that it comes from the future. You know, it didn't travel here in a DeLorean, right? So nobody's saying that, but it's about the dates that these graphs correspond to with Bob Rucker's thing correlate to the carbon-14 date. What is the amount of carbon-14 to carbon-12, that ratio? And because there's been contamination through Jesus' miraculous resurrection, and part of that event included neutron radiation from Jesus' body, it throws off the dating and makes it look like it comes from the future, but it doesn't actually date from that. So yeah, thank you, Hugh, for clarifying that. That should be obvious, hopefully. So yeah.
Yeah, I think it made that, now that makes more sense to me. So I want to say hi to Utopia Buster too. Here we go.
All right. Awesome. So yeah, cool. So that's it for the carbon-14 dating. Do you want me to move on to the Hungarian pre-codex, or is everything pretty clear for you?
Sure. Yep. I think it's pretty clear on the carbon dating. So that's very interesting information. I haven't heard that before. So good stuff.
Awesome. Yeah. I promise you, I'd bring you something new for your channel. So, all right, cool. So next up then, okay, look, we've kind of refuted the shroud skeptics. You know, they've got the Darcy memo and the carbon-14 utter failures. And in fact, the carbon-14 seems like it actually proves the pro shroud case in terms of neutron irradiation with those extra things I just mentioned. But pro-shroud guys, we also have our own independent positive evidences that date the shroud centuries before the carbon-14 would allow, according to the shroud skeptics' interpretation. We can prove it dates way before 1260 AD. And the first evidence that pro-shroud proponents will bring up is the Hungarian Prey Codex. And this is basically an illuminated Byzantine manuscript that contains two images that pro-shroud proponents will argue were created based on the artist being inspired from seeing the actual shroud images. And he encodes certain unique features that are indicative and unique to the Shroud of Turin as his inspiration. And the thing that's interesting here is that the Hungarian Prey Codex dates to between 1192 to 11, oh, that should say 1195. 1195 AD, right? So that would mean if the shroud, person who made the shroud images was copying an artist, supposedly copying based on looking at the Hungarian Prey Codex, well, obviously the shroud had to date, I said that wrong. Yeah, if the person who made the Hungarian Prey Codex was copying the shroud images, that would mean the shroud has to predate 1192 AD. It's that late or earlier, which is consistent with the first century. Now let's just take a little quick visual image of what we're talking about here. So here are the two images that are relevant for shroud research. The upper panel is the anointing of Jesus' body. You can see he's laying down on the shroud cloth. And, Joseph of Arimathea is pouring the oil on his body. The lower cloth is called the Three Marys at the tomb scene. You have the angel there. And, I'll get into a bit more of what we're seeing there next. But the first thing to say is when it comes to the Hungarian Prey Codex, we have scholarly consensus. And by this, I mean a qualified one. So I'm saying most scholars who've actually have an informed opinion. They've studied specifically the link between the Hungarian Prey Codex and the Shroud. Most of those scholars say that, yes, the Hungarian Prey Codex was copying the Shroud images. And here's proof of some of the experts who've done these studies. And here are some of the features that we'll go over next that they considered. But you can see right here, here's the degree. Look, Pooley, he's saying there's a 95 to 100% proven probability that the shroud was used to create the Prey Codex. Same with a textile expert, Methchild Fleury-Lindberg. She thinks there's a 95 to 100%. Whereas Cardini and Montesano, they're agnostic. They're not sure. They're about 50%, right? Here's the one that I want to highlight. Dr. Thomas DeWesselow. This is not a Christian. This is a non-religious agnostic, and he is a medieval art historian. He's an expert, and he is 95 to 100% convinced that the Hungarian Prey Codex was made copying the shroud. Now, out of fairness, there is another historian, Andrea Nicolotti, someone that Hugh Ferry loves as a fellow shroud skeptic. And by contrast, he's saying there's only a 0 to 5% chance. But as you can see, the vast majority of the informed scholars side with the pro-shroud side on this front. Okay, so let's look at some of these features. So looking at the upper panel, the anointing scene here, what are some of the arguments the pro-shroud side would give? Well, number one, they'll say, look at the position of the arms, just like the shroud man, crossed over his groin and the right over the left. And interestingly, no thumbs, right? And four elongated fingers, just like we see with the Shroud of Turin on the Shroud Man. That proves they must have copied the Shroud of Turin. Now, one thing I will say, just on the as a quick counter to that, I don't find this argument particularly persuasive, because look at this guy. He's missing a thumb too. So this could be just a stylized thing. But again, be aware this is an argument that pro-shroud will get. Another one that I am convinced by that I find interesting is the fact, well, look at this look at the body. It's nude. It is totally nude. Jesus is naked. And this is totally unprecedented at this time for this scene with Jesus in his crucified state and his body being anointed. You will never see Jesus totally naked. Now, shroud skeptics like Hugh Ferry will say, well, haha, look, we can find one or two photos of Jesus, pictures of Jesus naked before this, but it's always his baptism scene. and his manhood is always obscured by something like water or something like that. But they would never depict, before this, they would never depict Jesus naked at this holy time during his anointing. And that's what's unprecedented. And that's why pro-shroud experts and Thomas DeWeslow, that non-religious agnostic, admit, yes, he's probably copying the shroud here. So you can see that. There's also an epsilon shape. So if you see that here at the man's forehead, there's like a red smudge that looks like a bloodstain. Pro-shroud experts have argued this is the epsilon, that reverse three-shaped wound on the shroud man's forehead. So that's the pro-shroud point there. But there are important shroud skeptical points, right? So the other thing is to say, yeah, but Jesus has no other, where are his other wounds? Why, if he's depicting the epsilon wound here, where's his scourge wounds? You know, where's the holes in his wrists and stuff like that? I don't think that's a successful argument because obviously, you know, I mean, the artist would have known the Gospels, and these wounds are depicted in the Gospels. So I think it's just a stylistic thing. You can't determine anything one way or the other based on the lack of scourge wounds or wrist wounds and that sort of thing. But there is one shroud skeptical point that I think is really, that is successful. And that's the fact that, well, look at the beard. It's a really short beard. That's not indicative of the shroud. If we remember our argument from art history, it usually has a long forked beard because it's ripped out, like Isaiah says. But the Hungarian Praecodex is depicting Jesus with a short beard, unlike these other guys up here. So again, this artist is just choosing to, okay, he's selecting some features and he's not copying everything word for word, or it's based on memory. And for some reason, he's depicting Jesus with a short beard. But on a balance of probabilities, I do give this to the shroud skeptic that this is a negative point against it on the upper panel. So that's it in terms of the upper panel points. Then we have the most interesting and controversial one, the lower panel. And there are 9 points here. So I'll select. So one of them, okay, on the pro shroud side, they'll say, well, the dimensions fit, right? Like it's a long, this is the cloth, shroud cloth folded into 2 halves, and it's a long burial shroud, just like the shroud, 14 feet long. So that's a point there. They also say, look, this is clearly a cloth. Now, what does the shroud skeptic Hugh Ferry would say? He would say, no, you pro-shroud nutters, you're looking at this all wrong. This is clearly the lid of the tomb, and this thing with the red crosses is the side of the tomb. So they have a totally different way of looking at this bottom image here. Now, one of the pro-shroud points that argues against the shroud skeptics and for the pro-shroud side is they'll say, well, if this is not a cloth and it's instead the tomb lid, then they would represent it three-dimensionally, just like the artist did in the upper panel. Look, he's got the edges there. The three-dimensionality is depicted. That's not depicted here. So that probably means he's trying to represent a two-dimensional cloth. That's the first point that they give. They also point to this smudged corner, and they'll say it looks like it's kind of folded. There's a fold there, and that could imply that, yeah, it's the cloth is like folded over kind of thing, right? So that's the first pro-shroud point. Another pro-shroud point that I think is a failure is these red crosses. And they'll say, well, these represent the shroud man's blood stains. I don't think I can buy that myself. However, I will say that it is interesting. Why are they depicted as red? And something that at least makes the pro-shroud argument on this in terms of the crosses plausible is, look, I wish I could zoom in on this guy, but look, these are the scourge wounds depicted as red crosses. They look like little red crosses. So this makes it plausible that an artist could maybe use red crosses to symbolize the scourge wounds and blood stains.
So Dale, let me just, because I've got in the audience, you've got Hugh making a couple of comments about the Three Marys. Is one? Have you looked into the Three Marys pretty deeply, or?
Yeah. Like what? What about them?
He said he studied it in context, so I didn't know. Now the Three Marys, of course, we know that's Mother Mary, Mary the wife of Clopas, and or mother of or wife of Alphaeus or Clopas, and the mother of James and Jude, and it's also I believe Jude, and then also we have the others, and then there is the other Mary, of course, is Mary Magdalene. So those are the Three Marys. We do know that. We do know they're at the foot of the cross. So it was very likely that they would have been there when Jesus was taken down from the cross by Joseph of Arimathea.
So tell Hugh to hold his horses. I'm coming to that.
Are you serious?
But yeah, so that's the point on the Proshard side in terms of the red crosses there. Now, another one that I think is successful.
Really quick, I meant James and Joseph. Sorry.
No worries. So believe it or not, Proshard experts say that the blood belt, which is unique to the shroud, is in fact depicted on this area. So it's right here, these red wiggly lines. And I'll give you is that the close-up? Here it is. See these red wiggly lines out of nowhere, which just don't make any sense. They don't correspond to anything else. Proshard experts say this is the unique blood belt on the dorsal side of the shroud man, where the blood stain kind of curves and then goes across the small of the back. So this is another Proshard point in favor of the Prey Codex being copied from the shroud, is that it depicts these weird red wiggly lines right around the spot in the fold of the cloth that would correspond to where the blood belt is on the shroud man. Okay. The other one is that the herringbone weave is depicted, and I should have shown a cloth for this, but a video for this, but I don't have it. But so you see these little zigzags and step patterns. As a textile expert, Dr. Metchal Fleurlenberg says, look, this proves that the shroud man, the artist of the Prey Codex must have seen the shroud, because otherwise it wouldn't be possible for them to depict this herringbone weave pattern of the cloth that is unique to the shroud. Now, shroud skeptics like Hugh Ferry have come back and said, but this is not depicting, this is like a step stair pattern. It is not a herringbone pattern. But Bob Rucker came on my show and actually proved that's not true. If you were having a close look with the naked eye at the shroud cloth up close, as the artist, we know the artist of the Prey Codex would have gotten when he was in Constantinople, it does. You can make out stair patterns. The herringbone weave does come across as stair patterns. And I had Bob Rucker prove that on a show with Hugh Ferry, where we took a look at the visual image of that, and I should have put that on my slides, but I forgot. But so I think this is a successful argument here on the Proshroud side. Another thing from Bob Rucker that I think is interesting, I don't believe it, but it deserves to be mentioned because it's amazing, right? So people like Hugh Ferry will say, look, no, this crumpled up heap, that's the shroud cloth. Not the tomb lid, but this is the shroud cloth. And I've disputed that because I think that it's attached. But Bob Rucker's come up with a different explanation that possibly gives us more evidence for the shroud. Again, I'm iffy on it. I don't believe it, but I'll just mention it here. And what Bob Rucker says, you see this here, this is a knife. And what this is depicting is that somebody cut a piece of the cloth off corresponding to the face. And that's what Mary here is holding up. This part here looks like a face. Kind of thing. You can see the nose, the eyes, the mouth, and that sort of thing. So that's Bob Rucker's explanation for this. I think that's just pareidolia myself. I think that this is just showing that, yeah, part of the cloth is disheveled. And you have these two strips showing that it is actually attached to this long rectangle, which represents the shroud cloth. But yeah, just be aware of Bob Rucker's argument there. Now, lastly, the most important one, the clincher that even Hugh Ferry said he has a difficult time explaining those L-shaped poker holes. So let me get a close-up, right? So right here, these dots, and even Hugh Ferry has admitted on my show, these dots do not serve any decorative or any apparent functional purpose. They're just in the middle of nowhere. Well, they just happen to correspond to the L-shaped poker holes on the Shroud of Turin. And this by far is the strongest pro-shroud indicator that the Prey Codex, whoever made that, he saw the Shroud of Turin and was using unique features and depicting those on his cloth as he saw fit. So that's the pro-shroud side there. Now, to be fair to the shroud skeptics, so one point here is that, okay, well, if this is meant to be the shroud, why aren't there any shroud images? If this is the red crosses represents the inside of the cloth, the dorsal image, and then it folds up, right? Well, it's depicting the bloodstains and scourge wounds. Why isn't there any dorsal image of Jesus, of the body images? And yeah, I think that's a point that's worthy of consideration and is successful on the shroud skeptic side. But there are explanations to it saying, well, again, that he wasn't trying to depict the image. He wasn't trying to be accurate with all the things. He was taking the elements that mattered to him in depicting this shroud, and he left out the other things that didn't matter to him. Obviously, this artist is geometrically challenged. He's not the best artist that ever lived. He's not the greatest artist comparatively to others and that sort of thing. But it's clear that he's picking and choosing certain elements that were important to him. So that's kind of the pro-shroud counter to that shroud skeptical claim. Now we come to what Hugh Ferry was talking about. And I have to admit, this causes me personally some cognitive dissonance, but it's the prior probability argument. And Hugh Ferry has cataloged over 300 scenes or paintings of the three Marys at the tomb. And there is a remarkable correspondence to this lower panel and those images. So here I've included, so here are some of these scenes, right? So you have the tomb lid on the side, the angel sitting on it, side of the tomb, the three Marys, same on this, down here, and on the, so this is what Hugh Ferry was alluding to before. And he's saying, look, it's clear the Prey Codex is just, that artist sucks, admittedly, he's not good like these guys, but he's trying to depict the same thing these guys were. And that's what, this is the tomb lid, this is the side of the tomb, and this in the middle is the shroud that the angel is pointing to. So that's the shroud skeptical counter. I admit that is a successful point. So yeah, at the end of the day, you have to weigh up all of the pros and cons and decide for yourself, do you think that this artist was definitely copying the shroud images with these various features, pro and con? So that's it on the Hungarian Prey Codex. Any questions on that before I move on to it? Yeah, I still got time.
You guys, it's a really interesting chat here going back and forth, and lots of people are putting in some interesting information. It looks like this could be something to talk about. Hugh Ferry says, I don't know why the Prey Codex illustrator depicted an L-shaped pattern of shoes on the lid or a P-shaped pattern on the sarcophagus itself, but that doesn't mean they must be the poker holes. Did you want to kind of address that a little bit?
So in the first place, he's right that it's not 100% proven that it's the poker holes, but it is proven on a balance of probabilities. Like, it just seems ad hoc and frankly a little bit desperate on Hugh's part to deny the remarkable correspondence of this feature. Like, this single-handedly is the clincher for a lot of people to say, yeah, even Hugh himself admitted, look, these holes serve no functional, no decorative purpose. They're just totally out of place. So really, if we're looking for what's the best explanation, again, just taking this thing in isolation, the best explanation is that, well, yeah, this is a feature of the shroud image, the shroud that this artist saw, and for whatever reason, it stuck in his brain, and he wanted to depict it.
He said it should be circles, not shoes, is correct what I said.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, I was wondering. I was like, does he think it's like a boot or something?
Yeah, I was looking on the thing. And I'm like, I don't see shoes. I was just trying to figure out what that was.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm sorry on that front. Yeah, I just can't buy what Hugh is trying to sell. Again, with that aspect in explanatory isolation, because he's got good counters, such as that prior problem. That's something that I struggle explaining on the pro shred side as well. So, yeah. There's points for and against. Anything else?
No, we're good.
Awesome. All right, cool. So the last subject is one of my favorites, the Sudarium of Oviedo. So this is another evidence. And basically, if true, the Sudarium of Oviedo is the purported head cloth or covering that covered Jesus' head mentioned in the Gospel of John. And it currently resides in Oviedo, Spain. That's why it gets its name, Sudarium of Oviedo. And it has certain blood stains and body fluids, as well as dirt and pollen material on it, that pro shred experts say link it with the Shroud of Turin, meaning it covered the same corpse. Now, why is that remarkable? Because if they are linked, then that proves the Shroud of Turin can't be medieval. It dates as far back as the Sudarium of Oviedo does. And on that front, we can prove it dated historically at the very latest to about 570 AD when it was mentioned having existed in Jerusalem at that time at the Church of Mark or something like that, or it was in kind of a cave church in 570 AD and or earlier, right? So again, consistent with the first century, we know at the very latest, the Sudarium was around in 570 AD. And if we can prove that the Sudarium and the Shroud are linked, well, that proves the Shroud dates to 570 AD or earlier. So that's why this is relevant here. And the Sudarium has that well-established, relatively uncontroversial history well before the medieval period. Hugh will even delightfully agree that, and I saw him doing so in one of his shows, on a podcast, that, well, the Sudarium's even been carbon dated, remember, to 700 AD. And I'll address that in a second. Remember, that's consistent with Bob Rucker's neutron irradiation theory there, right? So that does, just because it was carbon dated to 700 AD, that doesn't mean the Sudarium doesn't go back to the first century in itself. But I'm going to give you a visual demonstration from an expert in the Sudarium, Caesar Barta, and he's going to explain for the next 7 minutes, how the Sudarium worked around Jesus. So 36:30 to 43:15. All right, 43:50. You guys are seeing the YouTube, Stephanie? Yep.
Yes.
Awesome. All right.
Do you know? No. Do you see?
Do I see? It's Jesus on the cross, and
then, okay, then. When the corpse of a man was upright and died an hour before, the Sudarium of Oviedo was put around the head.
Sorry, he speaks. He doesn't speak.
Most people have no clue that in 2023, Spanish, the best English, way to make money on Amazon is not with physical.
Putting on the words.
This is more clear. Showing of the arrangement, and now we can see how this was put maybe in this way. You see it?
Yep. Upside. Yep.
Okay. The red.
So he was showing how the Sudarium was folded. It was blocked, so it went around this much, and then it had to be refolded around.
Line simul the Sudarium, no? And they, by this moving, we can understand where was the face and where was the nape.
Okay.
Do you see?
Yep, it's showing up.
Okay. This part of the face was the forehead,
and this part was the nose and the mouth.
Okay.
And this part was the neck. This is the lock of hair in the back of the on the neck. Okay. And these are the bones of the crown of thorns.
Crown of thorns.
Okay. This maybe it's difficult to see, but this drop of blood is only the half of the drop, because in the middle of this drop there are no quantity of blood, and in the shroud there are the other part of this drop when the face of both cloth are matched. Okay, this may do easy to understand.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Then the Sudarium, when the corpse was upright, the all the stain below the nose was arrived the stain of the blood, the bloody stain arrived when below the nose when the corpse was upright. But after that, the corpse was put face down. And
so basically what he's saying here quickly is that they can tell from the bloodstains forensically, the body was in different positions when certain bloodstains were formed on this cloth. One was when he was up, still upright on the cross. Then they put his body face down. And,
yeah. In this moment, the above the nose, the forehead stain became in place. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Then the coincidence. This is the outline of the stain in the Sudarium of Oviedo, and at the left there are images of the shroud of Turin, and the whitest part are more or less the blood, mm-hmm. the blood. Mm-hmm. Then we turn a little
So let's just get clarity on the sudarium, because actually when I think about it, I'm not exactly sure about something with the sudarium. So there's a couple of instances where there was an instance when Jesus was carrying the cross and Veronica, I believe, approached him with a cloth and wiped his face just to kind of help him out. He's bleeding and sweating and everything else. And is that the same cloth, or is it a different cloth that was inside the tomb with Jesus on top of his face?
Yeah, that's a different cloth entirely. Yeah.
So this cloth found its way, because I understand this cloth, it's not nearly as what do you want to say, intricate or as expensive as the Shroud of Turin itself. Instead, it was a very cheap cloth, I guess. And it was just in there in the tomb that they used it maybe to wipe off his face, and they left it in there with him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they would have put it on him, on his head, while they were taking him down from the cross and while they were transporting his body to the tomb. But yeah, once they put it in the shroud, they took it off of him and threw it to the side, right?
And that's why it doesn't have any of the radiation on it quite the way the shroud does.
There are no
images. The shroud was wrapped around his whole body.
Exactly. Yep, exactly. This cloth was not any, it was over on the side. It wasn't covering the corpse of Jesus like the shroud was. So that's why there are body images on the Shroud of Turin, but there are no images on the sudarium. It it was not covering his head at the time. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay.
So Joe Marina says, Veronica's veil is believed by most scholars to be a legend, although some clearly identify it with the veil of Manipello.
Yeah, so I'm a Protestant. I don't believe it anyways, but Joe, I know Joe's a Catholic. So if even he's saying that's legendary, then yeah, like I just know it, these two cloths are different. And the Sudarium has evidence backing it up for sure. So yeah. All right. Well,
this outline.
Okay, so I guess I'll I'll stop playing him just because he's hard to understand. But I'll go back. So like how do we link these cloths, right? So we know what the Sudarium is claimed to be. But there have been various ways to link these two cloths. So I list them here. So the first are there are various anatomical similarities. So even though there are no body images or head images on the Sudarium, from the body, the blood stains and the shape, size, and location, and the body fluids, they can estimate the size of certain things to be the same. So, for example, the nose on the Sudarium and the Shroud is roughly the same millimeter, you know, 2280 millimeters squared on the Sudarium versus 2000 millimeters squared on the Shroud. So it looks like the nose is the same size. Also, the superciliary ridges. And again, they're not precise or exact because the Sudarium was covering the Shroud Man at different times in different positions. And as we'll see later, the Sudarium was actually tied and tight around Jesus' face while they transported Jesus to the tomb. And that's where he got that ponytail from, because they would have tied the Shroud cloth, the Sudarium cloth, to his ponytail. And then the blood would have dried and encrusted that ponytail in place. So the Sudarium actually helps us explain an odd feature about the Shroud Man's ponytail there. The superciliary ridges are the same. There's the absence of the right cheekbone, which corresponds to swelling on both cloths. Interesting. Swelling on the right side of the nose. Again, roughly the same size. The tip of the nose, nostrils, and nose wings are estimated to be the same. The position and size of the mouth, the chin, the shape of the beard. And most tellingly, that epsilon wound shape is there. So I find that sort of interesting, if you remember seeing that, and I'll show that. Secondly, the blood stains and body fluids have also been shown to be linked, especially on the crown of thorns. And Caesar Bard has done experiments on this, and using his own daughter. And he's proven that between the Sudarium and the Shroud, there is about a 75% correspondence between the blood stains caused by the crown of thorns, which link these two cloths as having covered the same corpse with the same wounds at the back of the nape or the neck. And just so, you know, Shroud skeptics might say, oh, this is a load of bunk. You can just cover any bloodied corpse or, you know, stab them in the head. You know, you'll get a match no matter what. Well, no. Caesar Barta has done actual computer simulations using his own daughter and other volunteers. And he has proven that just a random distribution of, you know, wounding someone with like a pointy objects in the head this way, it will not give you corresponding blood stains. Therefore, his conclusion is that the coincidence here proves they must have covered the same head with precisely the same wounds. And we'll see more on that later. So here's Caesar Barta. You can see the Shroud on the left is in green for the crown of thorns. And then what the Sudarium is, the crown of thorns right here, highlighted in red. 75% correspondence. They overlap and match. Now, Hugh Ferry, I'll be fair to him in the audience, he's come back and he's reversed it. And he says, well, this is just an illusion because the green is darker. So it looks like there's more of an overlap than there is. This is Hugh Ferry's diagram on the right. And he puts the red over the green. And he says, see, it's not really 75% matching. It's far less than that. Whereas Caesar Barta has, this is his image on the right. So those are the evidence and the claims on both sides of that. Again, Caesar Barta has written his book and actually done computer analysis to prove his claims about that 75% agreement. Hugh did a quick overlay, so take that for whatever it's worth. Also very interestingly is with the epsilon wound, right, that reverse three-shaped wound on the forehead, there's a little drop of blood attached to it here. But on the shroud, there's a hole in the blood. It's like a little blood donut. It's a missing hole. What Caesar Barta has discovered is that that blood, the blood that would go be in that hole is found on the sudarium. So here's the sudarium dot right here. And it would fit into this hole. Now, one of the problems is obviously this dot, because it's been smushed, it's actually bigger than the Shroud Man's hole, the Shroud Man's blood stain here. So it's not like it directly fits into the hole precisely. And that's what Hugh Ferry has come back as his skeptical claim. But I asked Caesar Barta about this issue, and he said, look, that's not why forensic artists link it. It's the relative location. Look, on the sudarium, you have this epsilon shape thing, and then this drop. Just like on the shroud, you have the reverse three epsilon wound, and then this drop corresponding. That's highly unlikely unless it covered the same with the little drop below on the bottom right of it. So that's how forensic artists are linking it. It's not a simplistic thing of just saying, oh, it's an exact precise match. No, remember, these cloths covered the bodies at different times in different positions. Again, originally the sudarium was on Jesus in an upright position. It was over him while he was carried, placed face down, then taken off. And there are so many parameters and variables that explain why there are slight differences. But why forensic artists are impressed with this is the remarkable coincidence that couldn't happen if it was just covering randomly different corpses, such as that epsilon thing with the dot located right in the same place on both cloths. The eyebrows match, the bloody eyebrows match on both cloths at the shroud, and this area corresponding to the nose and the mouth and the mustache. They all line up to show that it's covering the same corpse. And that's why on the pro shroud side, the forensic artists are saying, absolutely, this both cloths covered the same bloodied head, the same bloody and beaten head. Now, if this isn't enough, there was actually a 2016 morphological study and by Dr. Juan Manuel Menaro, and he was looking, pinpointing the points of origin for the blood stains, the wounds themselves. And he concluded that between the two relics here, it quote-unquote far exceeds the minimum numbers of proofs or significant points required by most judicial systems around the world to identify a person, which is usually between 8 and 12. Between the sudarium and the shroud, there seem to be 20 points of correspondence morphologically here, and that shows that two cloths, quote-unquote, are such that now it is very difficult to think that they came from different people. They came from the same place, and the points of origin for the wounds seem to match. So that's the morphological study in 2016. Then we have Caesar Barta's remarkable limestone dust comparison studies, and he looked at studied the limestone dust on the sudarium, and he matched it to what was on the shroud, specifically in the nose area. There is a very high concentration of this limestone dust done through X-ray fluorescence studies, and it links that the Shroud Man has this uniquely high isotope ratio, which corresponds to what's found on the sudarium isotopes in terms of the limestone. So that's another thing that really uniques it. Again, that was done, the X-ray fluorescence studies was brought by Caesar Barta, mentioned by him. Another thing is the pollen studies, and I'm just going to cite one of them, the 2016 Marzia Boys peer-reviewed findings, where they found a certain genus of pollen. So it's not enough to link it specifically to Jerusalem. We can't prove, oh, yes, the pollen definitely came from Jerusalem. I don't think we're there yet. I know there have been pro-shred experts who've claimed that, I just think the data is underdeterminative at this time. But what is remarkable about this pollen finding is it was found embedded in a blood stain on the Sudarium of Oviedo, which suggests it got there, and it's not later contamination. It got there where the blood was still wet. So it came from the same place as the body. And that is, it is, in the first place, it is consistent with Jerusalem. All the pollen findings are definitely consistent with Jerusalem. But it's also consistent with certain plants that were used in funeral rituals mentioned in places like Pliny the Elder and Dioscorides. I don't know how to say that, but these were real burial practices that were used only in the ancient world. They stopped being used in the 200s AD during the great crisis of the Roman Empire. So these funeral practices date because there was this pollen associated with these ancient funeral practices that didn't exist in the medieval period. They only existed up to the 220s AD. This means the Sudarium dates to 220 AD or earlier. And if I establish the forensic link between the shroud and the Sudarium from the blood stains, morphological studies, and the X-ray fluorescence studies, then that proves the shroud must also date from 220 AD or earlier. So that's why this pollen study is actually remarkable in terms of the dating of the shroud. I'm not using the typical pro-shroud argument saying that, oh, you know, Max Frey proved the species of the pollens, and that proves it comes from Jerusalem uniquely. That's controversial. You can make that argument. There was another study by Carmen Gomez Ferres who also attempted to identify the genus and the species of the pollen grains and tried to argue for Jerusalem. Look, I'm saying that regardless of that, that's a debate we can have, pros and cons. But regardless of that, the pollen from the 2016 peer-reviewed studies proves the dating of the shroud, because the shroud has been linked to the Sudarium. They covered the same corpse. And this pollen was embedded at the time the blood was still fresh and wet from the corpse, meaning, and it just so happens it is associated with funeral rituals that didn't exist after the great crisis of the Roman Empire. So that's pretty amazing evidence that needs to be taken into consideration. Finally, my last slide, the Sudarium's carbon dating, as I said, it was dated to 700 AD, but if the shroud and the Sudarium were neutron irradiated during the resurrection, all of this data has been proven mathematically by nuclear engineer Bob Rucker, that it all fits his hypothesis and model perfectly. So we have a ready-made explanation for that, and that's my presentation. I hope it was interesting.
Yeah, it was very interesting, and I can see you took a long time to put it all together. You did a really good job putting it together, and so very enjoyable. I think you made a pretty compelling case for the date of the shroud, the earlier dating, the matching up of all kinds of different little facts that you brought in there with the Sudarium of Oviedo, the C14 dating, the neutron stuff. So it's all really interesting. And so looking out here into the crowd here, does anybody have a question? We've got some really good people in here who are very familiar with the shroud. So you've got Hugh Ferry and of course our friend Joe Marino, who've both done a lot of research. Joe's pretty much devoted his life to it. And we also have Otangelo, who also wrote a book on the shroud, and he's been on my channel to talk about it. And so we've got some real shroud experts here. And Susan's been following all this stuff too, so she's keeping up with it. And I think Captive Desk has been making videos as a person who's a critic of this whole thing. So
yep, I remember my buddy Captive Desk there. So,
yeah, we've got both sides here. We've got several people who are anti-authentic shroud and others who are pro. What they never seem to answer, though, is how did the shroud's image get there?
Yeah, so again, my presentation today was strictly not about image formation. It was about three dating evidences and giving the pros and cons, because I want to be fair to both sides. Fair enough, Hugh. I wasn't addressing image formation at all. on that front, I will be addressing that on a future show if Stephanie wants me back and I didn't bore everyone to tears. But
no, I definitely would like to have you back because you talked about things that I have not talked about on my channel. When you first told me your topics, I thought, oh, wow, I've covered those on my channel before, but not at all into the deep length that you went.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. I keep my promises. I'm good to my word. Right. But I promised Stephanie something new on these topics. But in terms of image formation, just as I no surprise, I like Bob Rucker's hypothesis, because the great thing about his hypothesis is called the vertically collimated radiation burst hypothesis. And it not only explains the carbon 14 data of both the shroud and the sudarium simultaneously, it also explains the images, because basically at the moment of the resurrection, all of the particles in Jesus' body, the neutrons, would have affected the carbon dating. But what would cause the images? The protons as charged particles. Because interestingly, the protons would not penetrate the cloth. They would only go on the superficial layers of the shroud and create kind of like lightning bolts. And the linen fibers were acting as what are those things that attract the lightning bolts? Conductors or something? I forget what it's called. But anyway, so Bob has this extremely mathematically calculated out. Again, he's a nuclear engineer, and he's proven mathematically and scientifically that granted a vertically collimated burst of radiation at the moment of the resurrection, that's the supernatural miracle part, everything else follows the laws of physics and explains the images on the frontal and dorsal side, all of the minimal relevant features, and explains the carbon 14 dating at the same time. That's the thing I go for, is kind of one, that's the version of the radiation hypothesis I like. And I'll get in a future show, I promise, I'll get into all those details. I might even bring Bob on to explain his theory for you if you want.
Yeah, I'd like that, definitely. And so I've got a couple funny little comments here, like if we could get some people into a time machine, Hugh into a time machine, maybe Diagoras can be sitting next to him with captive desk, you know, maybe running the machine and then transporting the machine 2,000 years ago. Now they think they're not going to find much, but we think they would find something, so.
Absolutely. Yeah, that would be the quickest way to convert good old Hugh there. So Hugh's been following me around in the videos that I've been doing, and he hasn't been impressed, but one of these days I'll bring him around to the truth. So
yeah, good. No, I always I like the idea of people who have an open mind, because for many, many years I thought the shroud was a fake because of the 1988 stuff. And then I was watching on Steve McRae's channel, I was watching this shroud person, and all of a sudden I realized, oh gosh, this person thinks the shroud is true. And I thought, that's really strange. And I listened to what he said, and it was pretty compelling. So then I went and looked at the recent academic studies, and that led me to believe that the shroud is true. So I think if you're willing to have an open mind and not just say, I'm not doing anything, I'm not looking at anything since 1988, then you're not going to learn, like you're not going to advance, and it is possible to change your mind about things, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I am ashamed to admit. Yeah. Like I was totally closed-minded to the shroud myself. Right. It was, again, I just dismissed it. Oh, that's a Roman Catholic thing. I'm a Protestant. That's not for me at all. And it wasn't until I saw Gary Habermas actually taking it seriously that I gave it a second look. But it shows, yeah, like, even with me, like we all have our biases, and we have to get over that and be open to the evidence. And I think once you truly are open, the evidence from the shroud is extremely amazing. So yeah. Out of curiosity, the next time I do come on, what would you want me to cover as a topic? Would you like, do you have any favorites for?
Because you went into great depth here. I do think that the biggest curiosity and the thing that the skeptics really can't address is how the image got onto there. And so I think that would be a good presentation, looking at the recent research on people's theories on exactly how the image, because obviously when you die, we don't emit radiation. Like, how does that happen? So what is it about Jesus that's different than us? And you know what I mean? So, and then it's interesting. When you look at like Japan and you look at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the way that when the atomic bombs were dropped, sometimes people's human images were showing up on buildings there, kind of like the bomb went through their images and, you know, plastered it on a building. And so that's pretty interesting stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. I tell you what, I'll ask Bob Rucker to be on, because he'll give you a great presentation as to his theory. That's the one I go for as well. So yeah, we'll do that next time. So,
and it'd be good too. The other thing that I think would be interesting is looking at the flora and the fauna from ancient Jerusalem and trying to compare that with anything that they found on the shroud.
Gotcha. Okay. So the pollen studies.
Yeah.
In the same show. Yeah. Okay. I can.
Or it could be a different show. It could be, you know, we could do a couple different shows. We could just keep doing this every so often. I know you were trying to contact my old email. I went to the spam box. I can't find your emails. I don't know what happened. But you found me on my university email, and that is the speediest way to get in touch with me, because I check that literally probably hundreds of times a day. So
sounds good. I'll use that one. Thanks to Harry Stark for giving me that. So yeah, I'll use that. And yeah, well, I'll bring Bob on next time, because the image thing will be very great for your audience for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, and the other thing just to mention, I see Susan saying it's true for me. I do not feel like adamantly 100% believe that it is the shroud of Jesus, but I'm still waiting for contra evidence that is convincing. And so she's taken that position. And I think it's good just to have an open mind and keep taking in the evidence and then processing it and making a decision based on what the best explanation is.
I don't want to throw you for a loop, but I would be curious in your reaction. And I am totally unique in this front. Everyone literally disagrees with me, but hear me out, because you're talking about being open-minded. Mm-hmm. I've kind of made this argument, even on the pro-shroud side. So I believe the shroud probably covered Jesus, and that's what the evidence shows, right? But I've made the argument that even if the shroud skeptics turn out to be right, let's say the shroud is in fact medieval in terms of its dating, I say, who cares? All the scientific evidence about the images is still the same. We can still prove it's a miracle. And if it's a miraculous image meant to depict and attest to Jesus's death and death by crucifixion and resurrection, even if it's a medieval miracle attesting to Jesus, that still proves Christianity. All the science is still the same, even if it is medieval. So again, no one agrees with me, but I've made that argument that I don't even care if it dates Jesus. That's great. But either way, we have the evidence for the miraculous nature of the images is the same regardless of when that thing dates from anyways. So I don't know. Does that sound crazy or what?
Like, no, that sounds interesting. And anybody else here who's in here like to talk about the shroud on my channel as well, feel free just to shoot me an email. The alwayslearning1225@gmail.com does work. It's just that sometimes Gmail sends stuff to spam and I don't find it. And I did find one of your emails before in the spam folder, which is very annoying that they do that. So if you get desperate, I do have a university email. If I'm not responding, then just take a look at that, and you're fine to email me that way. I'm also with Hugh, who's, I don't know if he's still on here, but if he would like to, he said he's done a deep dive into the three Marys. And so, and I would be very, very curious to see what else he has to say about that. He's welcome to come on if he would like to tell us about that and about his theories on how the image got on the shroud. I would love to hear what he thinks, how he thinks that came about. Absolutely. But I do think, like what you're saying, it is miraculous. I mean, I think you just look at the shroud and the fact that we didn't even know what was really on it until 1898, when a photographer took a picture and looked at the reverse image. And so I think that that's itself, I think that drew a lot of attention to the shroud, and that's why it is the most studied relic in the world.
Exactly. Yeah, that Secondo Pia 1898 photo. Before that, the world scientists it's a painting. They just dismissed it. It wasn't until that photo, once they saw that, they realized, the scientists themselves realized, oh my gosh, there is something to this. And that's what led in 1900 to 1902 at the French Academy of Sciences, even a non-religious agnostic like Dr. Yves Delage was saying, this had to have covered a real corpse. There is something going on with this. And that's really what sparked off all the subsequent shroud research, including Stirp in 1978, where they discovered all of the features of the image, the physical and chemical properties there. Yep, there's Hugh Ferry.
Yeah, he says he's on about that. And so he would like to talk to the Quam. Now, I actually don't know what that is. The Quam Quiritus ceremony? So it's an Easter.
Okay. What? Yeah, I'm going to hook you up. It depends on you. It's your show. If you would want to do a debate, I can hook you up with a worthy competitor to Hugh named Jack Markwart. And my gosh, he knows the medieval history of the Shroud. So, and he's tackled Hugh on the Quam Quiritus thing. So, yeah, if you let me know.
I would love to host a debate. If you guys want to do a debate, I'm all about that. So I'm trying to make my, I'm always going to try to do shows at 4:30. I have been having such a hard time doing them on Wednesdays, though, because people at my university keep booking me on Wednesday at that same time. It's killing me. And so, and I can't do it the next two Wednesdays either. So I'm going to try to do shows on Monday at 4:30 or Sunday at 4:30 or Saturday. I can't do 4:30 because that's when church is, but I can do it on these other times. So I'm trying to do 4:30 stuff. So if you guys want to see if I'm running a show, I'm going to try the 4:30 time slot. I'm starting as associate dean at my school on June 1st. So that's also going to throw off my schedule. So it might end up being a weekend thing. So
very well, very well. Yeah. So yeah, 4:30, like I'm usually flexible. That it's not my favorite time, but I'm flexible because, I'm on your show as a guest. I think it would, Hugh's pretty flexible too. I'm not sure about Jack, but I need to check with them.
I like Saturdays, by the way. Saturdays are in the morning, like later part of the morning or right around noon. I'm good with that too. I usually am available then. So, gotcha. And he's in the UK. So for him, probably a morning time, like 11 o'clock, our time might be better for him.
Yeah, that's when I usually have him on my shows around between 11 and 1. And that usually works for him. So, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, we'll be in touch and we'll set that up. And obviously I'll be in touch with Bob too, because he's got great work on.
This is funny. So Joe Marino says, I need to retire and devote myself to the Shroud full time, which is what he's done.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's so much to the Shroud, right? I mean, Joe, he's published, it's over 100 academic disciplines are involved in studying the Shroud. So yeah, there's more than a lifetime's worth of evidence and information about it to study. So
yeah, it's fascinating stuff. It's really fascinating. So, well, everybody, thank you so much for coming in here today. Thank you, Dale, for your very extensive and detailed presentation. You did a real deep dive into all three of these areas. And so I think you provided information that everyone can use. And a lot of us will be still digesting it, like especially the thing with the neutrons. I'm still trying to process that whole idea in my mind that it shows up with a future date. And so I think that's interesting stuff. And so, when I say 4:30, it's definitely Eastern time. So thank you, Captive Desk. Thank you, Joe Marino, Susan, Hugh, Utopia Buster. Who else is in here? I saw Blaster Master in here. So just to mention a few people, I like it when I go on the channel, I kind of like when people mention all the names of people in the chat. So Joe Marino, Diagoras of Malos, Hugh Ferry, Otangelo. So we just got a really good group of people.
Blaster Master. That's I've never seen that before. That's a new one for me. So
yeah, he's an atheist, I believe. So I think we've got a few atheists here. Oh, and Shiami. So thank you, Shiami, too. It's really good seeing you guys. And so if you guys like this kind of content, please like, subscribe, share it with your friends, and do come again. And also just remember, whether you eat, drink, or whatever you do it all for the glory of God.
God bless.
Peace up, A-Town. Yeah!
Yeah, boy.